all across the world, there was comments about independence would be difficult for Britain. Independence would be a backward step for Britain. They even had the shipyard sending letters to shipyard workers. Well, if you vote for independence, we can't guarantee your jobs. They had Tesco's and B&Q threatening, oh, if you vote for independence, we may have to withdraw from Scotland.
It was a
pile of utter manure, verbal manure. It was designed to frighten people. And the one section of the population that was frightened more than any other was the elderly, because they said to them, your pensions might not be secure. No basis whatsoever to suggest the pensions weren't going to be secure. In fact, in an independent Scotland, you'll get a better pension. Because that's what we're about.
Tommy, how you doing, bro?
I'm fine, brother. Yeah, I'm fine.
Good, man. Tommy, first off, I want to thank you for coming and doing this. I really appreciate it, obviously. Kind of spoke earlier. As I was a young man, you were obviously elected to Parliament. I think I would have been sort of 13, 14. I'd obviously seen you sort of, well, as I've grown up, I've sort of seen you, you know, through the TV. So, obviously, I don't know you. I really appreciate you coming and doing this. I think it shows the kind of character you are. So, thanks for that. Off the get-go.
Paul, I've only just met you, mate. You seem like a nice guy. But Christine Cooper is an excellent friend. She's somebody who has supported me through thick and thin over many, many years. And she's done lots of favours for me in the past. So when Christine contacts me to ask me to take part in something, quite frankly, I didn't care who you were. I would have done it because of my friendship with Christine. And I think friendships are very, very valuable. You need to make sure that you don't let friends down.
No, absolutely. I don't know Christine either. I just know her through her daughters, goes out with one of my pals. So
Great, there you go.
The circle of life there, Tommy.
Absolutely, pal. Absolutely.
So I seen on Facebook you're a social worker now, or training to be a social worker. I think this is probably your third degree. So you must really love that shooting discount, Tommy.
Well, exactly. My wife Gail says I should set up a band and call it the Four Degrees, because I've now got four separate degrees. I've got my economics in politics, I've got a master's degree in social research, I've got a law degree and a practice law diploma, and now I've got a master's degree in social work as well. So we formally graduate in June, but I finished my placement the other day, and we now are at the stage of applying for jobs. Also, that's what's happened. I was a couple of interviews on Friday, actually. At long last, as Gail said, I'm going to stop being a student and start being a worker.
Well, it's about time, probably, yeah,
exactly.
After all your campaigning.
That's what my mates say. My mates say, for Christ's sake, most of us are retiring at 60 and you're just starting to work. Such is the circle of life. There you go.
That's funny. And what made you want to segue into sort of being a social worker then, Tommy? I think your mum and your sisters were sort of involved in this field, were they?
Yeah, Paul. First of all, obviously I was in politics for a long time. I represented Glasgow City Council. I was a councillor for Pollock, where I was raised. I represented the area for 11 years. Then I was in the Scottish Parliament, representing Glasgow for 8 years. So for a long time, I was involved in politics. Lost my seat in 2007 election, and had to think about, you know, what other things to get involved in. And one of the things I did was a master's degree in social research. One of the attractions to doing that degree was the coordinators of the course offered me a quid pro quo arrangement, which was that if I was willing to teach during the year, then they would wipe out the fees. They would make that part of the payment of fees if I would take on being a tutor and doing some lectures. And I loved it. It was sociology, and I was getting to speak to a lot of young people about very important ideas. And my classes were very, very popular. Also, that was in 2008. I then decided to embark on a law degree. I'd been in and out of courts that many times in my life, and I'd represented myself loads of times. So Somebody challenged me once. They said, "Ah, it's all right, you represent yourself, but you could never become a lawyer because you couldn't get the degree and all that." And I thought, "Oh, bugger you! I'm going to prove that I could get the degree." So I applied to do the law degree. Started that in 2009, but then I had an ideal, fantastic reason for missing my law exams in the winter of 2009. I remember getting to speak to the course coordinator and asking for a dispensation for not being able to attend the exams. And my reason was very, very unique. And my coordinator said it was the first time he'd ever heard it. And that was that I couldn't do the exams in the January of 2009 because I was going to be in the Big Brother house. So I couldn't make it. Because I would be in London. He said it was the first time he'd ever heard that as an excuse. So I had to then put that degree on ice to do the Big Brother appearance. And then I picked it up again a couple of years down the line. A lot of water went under the bridge. I was in court, got convicted in 2010. And then I got a 3-year sentence, did a year behind bars and 6 months on the electronic tag, and then went back in 2013-14 and did the law degree. 2015 did the law diploma, and then realised the law wasn't for me, Paul. I was offered a few apprenticeships in law. Once you have graduated, you need to go and work in a firm for at least 12 months before you become a fully fledged lawyer. And I fast found myself in a job that I wasn't suited to. And I don't want to criticise any lawyers because they do their job to the best of their ability. But I once sat down with a friend of mine who used to work in the Evening Times, a guy called Ron McKenna, who then went later in his life to become a lawyer, and said to him, I said, "Look, Ron, I've got a problem here. I've had a couple of cases where people have asked me to represent them. And one of them in particular was quite a serious assault case. And I know for a fact that the guy did it. Somebody got stabbed. And I just wasn't comfortable defending the guy." Now, that's wrong legally because everybody deserves a defence, but no for me. I just found myself, I can't do it. The guy's done this, I'm going to begin in defending him. I don't think it was defensible, so I gave up and decided that I wasn't going to become a lawyer. I then got offered a job, Paul, working for Sputnik, producing my own shows, news shows, interviews and writing opinion pieces, which I did for 3 years, and it was probably the best job I've ever had. It was even better than Parliament in some respects because I had no restrictions on what I wrote, what I researched, the programmes that I made. I was able to talk about John McLean, James Connolly, talk about the 1919 Glasgow rent strikes and the big 40-hour strike, talk about history and talk about current events. Have a go at the hypocrisy of the United States whenever I wanted. So it was a fantastic job, well paid. Unfortunately, COVID led to the withdrawal of Sputnik from the UK in 2021. So I was left with, I've just realised this is a long, long answer to your original question, but I was then left with, well, what do I do now? And my sisters were both qualified social workers. My mum had been a qualified social worker. She'd left school with no qualifications, but went back as a mature student in her 30s to become a social worker. So my sister said, "Why don't you apply to Caledonian University? They do a master's degree. They are very friendly towards mature students. You've got a lot of the academic qualifications. You have represented people all your life, so you've got a lot of the values that social work very much is about. Why don't you apply? So I applied, and I started studying the social work degree in 2022. 2024 is a 2-year degree. I'm now more or less qualified. So that's the journey to becoming a qualified social worker. I'm following in the footsteps of my two sisters and my mum, God rest her soul, and I'm sure she will be very, very happy.
Oh, that's nice. You mentioned the sort of journey there, and I'm interested that I think your story's pretty well known. You're obviously a sort of political heavyweight, I would say, in the sort of Scottish political scene anyway. So obviously mentioned politics there, but can we go a bit deeper on that? Like, have you traced your sort of family heritage, like, so the sort of grandparents, the great-grandparents, and how's that shaped your sort of the way you operate, you know, in life and your philosophy? Do you think that's had any influence on it?
It's a reasonable point, Paul. My grandparents, via my dad's side, were Irish immigrants. So they were born in Ireland and travelled and moved to Glasgow in search of work. Ireland at that time was a very depressed place, and unemployment and poverty was rife. And many, many Irish moved to Glasgow, Liverpool, Birmingham, other cities across the UK in search of work. My mother's side, interestingly enough, my gran's mum, I traced her roots back to Palermo in Italy.
So that's the tan then.
So that's the tan.
It's no sunbeds.
I'm hoping to eventually trace some mafia links and maybe to set up in the future, you know. But the whole Irish immigration background, I think, is important, Paul, because all of my life I've tried to campaign against the intolerance of anyone who wishes to come and live here in our country. I don't care whether they're coming here on the basis of poverty or in search of a job. I don't look at somebody and class them as an immigrant. I look at somebody and class them as a human being. And I hate the way we have allowed the dehumanisation of people whose only crime in their lives is to try and search for some security for themselves and their families. Things that we would do if we were in their shoes. As I've said to others who have tried to spout what I believe are regressive and right-wing views about we should stop immigration, we should put up the walls and we shouldn't let people in, I keep saying to people, well, see, if you want to stop people coming to our country in search of jobs and in search of a new life, then maybe we should stop bombing their countries. And if you want to stop immigration, why don't you stop supporting those that actually do the bombing? You name the country: Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Libya. These are the countries where people are fleeing from. Well, largely because we destroyed them. We bombed them to smithereens. Is it any wonder that people in those countries then decide we're going to go and search for a new life elsewhere? So I don't look at people and class them as immigrants. I look at people and class them as human beings. I don't care where they come from. They live and breathe and they bleed just like you and I. And I think humanity demands that we look at people as people, that there's no such thing as an illegal. Everybody has the right to live. And if that right to live is it in our country, then let's make it the best country in the world to live and work in.
Amen to that. I totally agree with you there. That's similar to my story. So my mum's mum was from Ireland originally, and she sort of moved over here in search of a better life and met my granddad and that sort of stuff. So I think I've got a similar political philosophy yourself based off of that, basically. And when I came to university, I read a book, just random, one of the, you know, serendipity moments in life where I was in one of these sort of bookshops in Glasgow, and I think it was called Glasgow, and it was about the Irish migration to Glasgow, you know, post the sort of famine, and it talks about how these people came over and they built the roads, they built the schools, they built the transport, they worked in the railways, and all those discrimination issues they faced, and it totally just sort of reinforced that belief I had about humanity, that if you want, you can live your life out of fear and think that you're not doing well because of immigration policy and that sort of stuff. But really, it's a lot more complex than that, and we should treat people as human beings, absolutely, as you say.
Definitely, Paul. I mean, the argument I keep trying to make to people is don't blame other poor people for poverty. They're the victims. They're no the perpetrators of the problems. If you want to, when people talk about, oh, we should stop the boats, stop the boats. I say, never mind stopping the boats. What about the yachts? The yachts are the problem. They're bringing in the multi-billionaires who are there to exploit, to avoid paying their taxes, to make sure they can hire and fire at will. I've got more problems with the yachts. I've got no problems with the boats. And it's that type of attitude that we need to try and get over to people. We need to try and inspire a belief in working class people that, listen, we are all the same. We're all cut for the same cloth. We are not the employers of labour. We are not the owners of capital. We are not the ones that are making the decision. We are the ones that are exploited, and we're commonly exploited. Look, you mentioned there the history of Irish immigration. I remember reading many of the stories at the time, a lot of anti-Irish sentiment was because Irish workers were used as blacklegs, were used as scabs during strikes. In the turn of the century, if you had strikes in the mines, if you had strikes in the steel yards, the shipyards, what did the employers do? Well, the dirty bastards went, and they went to the Irish immigrants who were unemployed and poor. They offered them jobs at less pay than what the workers were on in order to break strikes. Now, you would argue, oh, the workers shouldn't have agreed to that. And ultimately, many of the Irish became the best union organisers, and they became involved in the unions. In the early days of that whole story, they were used to break strikes, and that led to a lot of anti-Irish sentiment. But they then became organised, and that's what the labour movement has got to do. It's always got to look at those that are immigrants and say, you don't attack them, you get them organised, you get them part of the union. That's the way to attack the employer. The employer loves nothing more than us all fighting each other. You know, the Catholic against Protestant, black against white, Asian against Indian against Pakistan, you name it. As long as there's division, the boss is pissing himself because he knows if you're fighting each other, you're no fighting him for better pay, for better conditions. We've got to unite the working class. That's what our philosophy as socialists should always be about.
Hi. So on that point then, you're all pals. I don't know if you're still pals with him, but gorgeous George Galloway just get elected there in Rochdale. What's your thoughts on that?
I sent George a number of messages in the run up to the election, wishing him all the very best. George sent me back a wee kiss and thanks, Tam. He always refers to me as Tam. We go back a long, long time. Listen, I mentioned friendships earlier at the start of the talk. Paul, friendships are very important to people's lives. It makes up the fabric of your life, the tapestry of your life. George and I have been pals over 30, 40 years, going back to the early days of the anti-poll tax campaign when he was the MP for Hull Head, and we had to organise to defend his house because he was one of the non-payers, to defend his house from sheriff officers. So that friendship is quite deep. And George and I had fundamental disagreements during the 2014 referendum campaign. I'm very much for independence. George believes in a British road to socialism. I don't. I don't think there is a British road to socialism. I think the road to socialism will be through independence.
Sorry to interrupt you, Tommy, but I was wanting to talk to you about that because you were part of, obviously, the militant wing of the Labour Party back in the day, right? So weren't they always for independence, presumably?
Absolutely, Paul. I got brought up. I joined the Labour Party when I was 17 years of age, and I joined ostensibly because my mum encouraged me to join. My mum was always a union organiser. She was a Labour Party member. She encouraged me to go to uni. I didn't have a clue about university and all that. I didn't even want to stay on at school, but she encouraged me to stay on at school. I always used to argue with her that I want to change the world and all that, and she said to me, son, before you can change the world, you need to learn how it works. Then you can change it. So that was always the advice that she would give me. So I went to uni, joined the Labour Party in Stirling. I went to Stirling University. And immediately when I was there, there was a group of people selling a newspaper called The Militant. And they spoke a language that I understood. They spoke the way I could comprehend. They spoke about class issues. They spoke about organising and housing schemes. Some of the Labour Club members were more mealy-mouthed and didn't really speak my language. So I was immediately attracted to that particular organisation because it was working class. And that became my education. Paul, I have to say that being involved in the Militant was a fantastic education politically. However, in those days, the Militant was very much a British socialist organisation, and they believed that there was a British road to socialism. So when I was reading John McLean, Nan Moulton, her brilliant attempt to explain her father's life, I was reading about this guy, Fee Pollock Shaws, who was a working class tribune, a fighter against injustice, a fighter against the First World War, arrested five times throughout his life, somebody that was prepared to take on Goliath in the name of working class unity and against injustice and poverty. And he believed in a Scottish Workers' Republic. That's what he stood for, a Scottish Workers' Republic. He believed that we were more likely to secure socialism in Scotland first, and that that would then be an encouragement to England and to Wales. He also believed in a united socialist Ireland as well. And I loved what I was reading. I thought it was brilliant. But my teachings at the time via the Militant was John McLean was a wee bit too far advanced. He died in 1923. He never lived to see the 1926 general strike. If he'd seen the general strike, he would have known that the British working class would have caught up with the Scottish working class, and therefore he was wrong to advocate for a separation of Britain at that time. And a lot of that, you know, sounded quite logical. I thought, oh, well, that's got logic to it. But the more I read, and the experience of the anti-poll tax campaign, which started in Scotland, it became British-wide, but it started in Scotland, and the more I analysed politics from the miners' strike through to the anti-poll tax campaign, it became clear to me that if you are an internationalist, because one of the arguments against being for independence is, oh, you're not an internationalist because you want Scotland to be independent. And I kept saying to myself, but wait a wee minute. The other side of that coin, if you're saying I'm a nationalist, I'm a Scottish nationalist for wanting independence, I think I'm an internationalist, but you're calling me a Scottish nationalist because I want independence. Well, you need to accept the other side of that coin is you want to keep Britain. You must be a British nationalist. Oh, all of a sudden, those that believe in keeping Britain as a unitary state and oppose Scottish independence, they don't want to be known as a British nationalist because of the connotations of what British nationalism, the bulldog atmosphere that is created, the way the St George's flag has been commandeered by the right. They don't want to be known as British nationalists. And quite rightly, because Britain's history is nothing but blood-soaked, absolutely blood-soaked. They have dominated, raped and pillaged away across the planet. At one time, two-thirds of the world was under the tutelage of British imperialism. It is a horrible, horrible history that has been based on exploitation, theft of natural resources, colonisation. It is a history that is absolutely shameful. And I began to realise around about 1990-91 that, wait a wee minute, being an internationalist means you want to break British imperialism. How could you be somebody who, for instance, applauded the Irish uprising of 1916, applauded the bravery of the likes of Conley and Padraic Pearse, who sang songs in tribute to those that stood up against British imperialism, but you wanted to maintain Britain's rule over Scotland. It was just stupid. It was illogical. It was irrational. For me, I'm not, others can defend it themselves. So around about 92, I became absolutely convinced that John McLean wasn't ahead of his class. John McLean was articulating what was correct for his class, and that was emancipation through independence, through a Scottish Workers' Republic, and through a socialist world. Yet McLean could never, never be described as anything other than an internationalist, but he believed fundamentally on an independent Scotland, an independent socialist Scotland. So that's my sort of a shift in my political development over the years, Paul. So I understand where the likes of George comes from and where the likes of others who are still, I would say, they've got problems with the issue. During the campaign, I debated with the likes of Diane Abbott on several BBC shows, and I could tell that Diane was uncomfortable with defending her position. Owen Jones, a Guardian columnist, debated with him. He was uncomfortable by opposing Scottish independence. What you had to understand in relation to the movement for independence in Scotland, because people would refer to it as a nationalist movement. And of course, if you look at nationalist movements across history, there is a relationship with the nationalism of the Nazis, the nationalism of chauvinism, the nationalism of exceptionalism, the nationalism of bigotry. But you go on a nationalist march in Scotland, and it's welcome refugees, it's stop the war, it's uniting the working class. It was a progressive movement.
Still is.
And still is a progressive movement, Paul. And from that point of view, our job, I've done quite a few meetings in England where I've been invited to go and speak to socialist gatherings and convince them that they've got nothing to fear from the movement for Scottish independence. On the contrary, they've got everything to gain. Gerry Cinnamon, who's now an accomplished performer, but before Gerry became very well known, we hosted Gerry, the Hope Over Fear independence campaign, hosted Gerry several times in George Square, and he wrote a song. He attended a meeting that I'd spoke at in Glasgow, and he went home that night and wrote a song. He said he wrote that song based on the meeting that he'd attended, and it was called Hope Over Fear. And there is a line in that song about, are we abandoning the English? And he says, don't be silly, they're waiting for our lead. Liverpool, London, Coventry, they're waiting on our lead. And it's such an important song because it actually sums up exactly what independence is about. Independence is progressive for us. It's not because we're any better than anybody else, but we're not any worse than anybody else either. And in our independent Scotland, we're no building walls that are reflective of Hadrian. We are handing out the hand of friendship and saying human solidarity is what we're built on. That's what our independence is about. That's what our message is about. There's nothing that is regressive about our nationalism here. It's a progressive movement, and we want you to get on board. So George doesn't agree, but what he did agree with, George came and spoke. I stood as a solidarity candidate in the 2007 Scottish Parliament elections, and George came and spoke on several platforms in support of my candidature. And although I stood for an independent socialist Scotland, and George didn't support an independent Scotland, what George supported was the right for a referendum, that Scotland had the right to have a referendum. So he supported that. I'm not 100% with George on the question of independence, but it doesn't mean we're no pals. George and I were arrested together down at Faz Lane in 2001, I think it was, 2001, 2002. Several arrests down there, but I remember George has since talked about how the flame of the socialist cause has been passed from generation to generation. He makes the point that during that particular instant, he realised that it was time for the flame to be passed, because he talked about hearing a conversation between two senior cops when we were all on the road protesting against the inhumanity and illegality and immorality of nuclear weapons, and we refused to leave the road outside the Fazley nuclear submarine base, so the police were getting prepared to arrest us, to lift us up and carry us into vans and arrest us. And he says that he heard one of the cops saying, "I'll take Sheridan, you take the Elgin." So he knew then that the flame of socialism had been passed to a new generation. I would need to say now that I'm passing on to another generation, because I recently turned 60, Paul. So I hope that I'm confident there are a new generation of young socialists coming through.
There's loads to unpack there, Tommy, but I'll try and keep it a bit light, because we're probably going to go through the waves here with loads of different topics. So you mentioned Gerry Cinnamon there, obviously. He was actually the last song in the car before I got to the Canterbury Zone, so it's quite symbolic, I think. But you had, obviously you mentioned Hope of Revere. I've been to the rallies as well, so have you had many interactions with Gerry sort of person? Has he come to the house and play the guitar and all that? Or?
Not to the house, no, but Gerry and I were very, I mean, if you look at some of the footage of the rallies that Gerry attended, you know, we shared a few tears together, because the response to his songs, and particularly Hope Over Fear, he used to finish the rallies with Hope Over Fear, and the response for the thousands in the square was absolutely phenomenal. And he was there when my wee daughter introduced me at one of the rallies, and it caused me to cry, because she introduced me so eloquently, and I was so proud of her, and Gerry was over the moon with that. So we were very, very friendly at that stage. However, it appears that Gerry's managed, at that time Gerry wasn't managed. He was an artist who wrote his own stuff and did his own performances in pubs and clubs across Glasgow, and built up a fantastic following. However, a management team got in tow with him, and one of their insistence was that he drop the independence rallies, and he doesn't appear any longer at our events. One of the reasons being, I can understand it, if he wants people to pay money to go and see him playing in big venues, then how can he justify going and playing for free at George Square, which is what he was doing? And one of the other arguments from his management team was that he had to appeal to the whole of Scotland, and Scotland was very divided at that time, and therefore he should tone down his support for independence. Gerry was a young man from Castlemilk who was desperate to become a successful artist, and to get his artistry wider audiences. So he did what he thought was right. And I'm not going to have a go at the young man. He's a fantastically talented artist. I love his stuff. I love his talent. And I know in his heart of hearts, he's a very progressive young man. But if he's going to sign up with a management team, then they've obviously got certain conditions that they imposed on him.
I know, it's a shame to hear that though, obviously, because like you were speaking about, it seems like the establishment, that's the agenda they're pushing into, you know, they're part of the sort of divisiveness, so it's a shame that they're putting them down that route, unfortunately.
Well, I think at this time, Paul, they were looking at it from a point of view of he has to try and get a unionist and those who support independence to buy his albums, to buy his CDs, to buy... I kind of download the things. I'm terrible with a lot of the modern forums of, in my day, you bought an album and then it became a CD. Is it downloads or something, or whatever it's called? You go and pay for them. Anyway, Gerry had to try and appeal across the board. He would be welcome back, particularly, I'll put a plug out, I hope Gerry's watching this particular recording, because we've got the 10th anniversary in September, 14th of September, We're back in George Square, 10 years on for the first rally in George Square that Jerry performed it. We had about 15,000 people turned up, and we're hoping to have a big anniversary rally to let the whole world know that we're still for independence and we're not gone away. You know, the unionists and the establishment might think they've destroyed us, but they've not destroyed us, because it's in our hearts. You can attack the cause, and you can attack those that are promoting the cause, but the cause is bigger than any one individual. The cause will live on in the hearts and the minds of new generations of young people who believe it's unbelievable that you've got a country that isn't able to make its own decisions, that isn't able to take the decision about whether you go to war or no, the decision about whether you spend money on nuclear weapons or spend them on a hospital instead, that you buy school books instead of bullets. That's the type of decisions that Scotland should be able to take. And I'm confident if we were taking those decisions, we wouldn't have collecting cans for MRI scanners for the hospitals. You would have collecting cans for nuclear missiles, and good luck to them out in Buchanan Street raising money for nuclear bombs. But that's the only way they would be getting the money, because we would be spending the public money making sure nurses and teachers and other public services were well resourced and well paid, because that's what matters to people's lives.
Absolutely. So on the subject of independence then, obviously I think the SNP commissioned some sort of report, I don't know if it was Stuart Hosey or somebody that was doing it, to try and figure out, you know, what went wrong with the referendum campaign, how can we persuade people to obviously go for a no to a yes and stuff like that. So what's your kind of take on what people who are supportive of independence should focus on in terms of trying to persuade no voters, I suppose, because it seemed, my take was, it seemed as though the vote was swayed heavily by the older sort of generation in Scotland. I think they were nervous about maybe pensions, using the pound, you know, mortgages, things like that. But as I understand it, pensions in Scotland are among the lowest in Western Europe. So hopefully in an independent Scotland, we might be able to change that.
I was invited on to the analysis show on the night of the referendum in the heart of the beast, so to speak, at the BBC headquarters in Glasgow. And as the results were coming in, it was quite clear that we had lost the vote that night. And there was quite a lot of chest beating and over-optimistic comments from some of the unionists. One of them came in, I was sitting next to John Reid, who used to be a socialist apparently, is now an ardent unionist. And one of the tweets come in, wee Glenn Campbell, who sadly is ill just now, but wee Glenn Campbell read out a tweet from Joanna Lamont, who was at the time the Scottish Labour leader, and it was to congratulate the Better Together campaign on a marvellous victory. And I said there and then, you can go back and check it, I said the unionists across Scotland should make sure they celebrate heavy tonight, because in the morning they're going to wake up and realise that they've won nothing more than a Pyrrhic victory. And I advise them to go and read into the history of the Greek general, where the term Pyrrhic victory became named from, because in the advance of winning a particular battle, then General Pyrrhic lost so many of his troops that he ended up losing the war. And that's where the term Pyrrhic victory comes from. And for me, what the unionists did in 2014 is they won a Pyrrhic victory. Because what we did is we won the hearts and the minds of particularly the new generations of Scotland, the young people in Scotland. You look at every single indicator of that referendum, you're talking about over 70% of young people voted for independence. Those young people are now older people. They don't now believe in unionism. They believe in even more ardently for independence. And the new generation below them believe in independence. I think independence is inevitable. And I think when we are analysing 2014, Paul, don't be quick to call it a defeat. We started at 23%. That was the opinion polls around 2013. I remember reading the Scotsman Gallup opinion poll and the social attitude survey that was carried in The Guardian 2013, 23% was what support for Scottish independence was. That's why we were given the referendum. I mean, Cameron and co thought, this is a shoo-in, doesn't matter, give them the referendum, they're going to get beat anyway. We went from 23 to 45. By any standard, that's a fantastic result. Absolutely fantastic. We went to 51 a couple of weeks before the actual referendum, and that caused panic in the ranks of the British establishment. They called in every favour possible. They called in the bosses of the Asdas and the Tesco's and the B&Q's, the banks, the shipyards. They even got Barack Obama on board. They got the Chinese Premier on board. They got Putin on board. All across the world, there was comments about independence would be difficult for Britain. Independence would be a backward step for Britain. They even had the shipyard sending letters to shipyard workers. Oh, if you vote for independence, we can't guarantee your jobs. They had the Tesco's and B&Q threatening, oh, if you vote for independence, we may have to withdraw from Scotland. It was a pile of utter manure, verbal manure, but it was designed to frighten people. And the one section of the population that was frightened more than any other was the elderly, because they said to them, your pensions might not be secure. No basis whatsoever to suggest the pensions weren't going to be secure. And as you've already said, it's one of the lowest pensions in the whole of Western Europe anyway. But there was no basis to suggest it was going to be insecure. But that was the seed that was laid in the minds of a lot of pensioners. Oh, you might not be able to get your pension in an independent Scotland. Why? Why would you not get your pension? Of course you'll get your pension. In fact, in an independent Scotland, you'll get a better pension. Because that's what we're about. We're about making sure that people get a bigger share of our national wealth, because there's a recognition that Scotland is massively, massively rich in natural resources like our wind and our water and our oil and our land, but we've also got the rich resource of our people, a very, very well-educated people, a university sector that is fantastic and is envied across the world. Those are the resources that, if you put them together, could give you better wages, better pensions, better share of the national wealth. And it's from that point of view that we have to say, Paul, that although we lost that vote 10 years ago, the cause of independence is more important and more urgent now than it's ever been, and it's not going away.
So to go back to the George Galloway thing then, do you think... We'll just say it as it is, right? It looks as though George was, I would say he was galactied, obviously, based on his stance on sort of the Israel-Palestine conflict there. So do you think there's more scope for that to become part of in politics in Scotland? To be fair to the SNP, I think they're doing a good job sort of fighting the fight for that there. But I suppose what I was wanting to ask is, do you think we'll see more independence becoming a thing in Scotland? Because... obviously, at the UK level, we've got a two-party system, effectively, and I don't see much of a difference between the Labour Party as it stands and the Tory Party, so I certainly couldn't give them my vote, two sides of the same arse cheek, because I think George says. So in Scotland, when you were elected, there was obviously independence, I think Dennis Canavan and a few other people, so do you think we'll get back to that? Because a lot of people have been giving the SNP their vote for a few years now, but... if they're not putting independence on the table, then maybe, you know, there's an avenue for a new movement, potentially.
It's an interesting argument, Paul. It's worth bearing in mind that George, believe it or not, has never been elected as an independent. He was elected as a respect candidate in the two previous elections, and he was elected as a Workers' Party of Britain candidate in Rochdale. However, the point you're making is that people... probably don't even know that.
I misspoke. I mean just mere parties that are away from the mainstream is kind of the point I was trying to make, sorry.
Well, there is two arguments, because in my day in the Scottish Parliament, there was actually the election of the likes of Dennis Canavan as an MSP in the constituency. He was so well known and he'd represented the area for so long that when he was kicked off of the official list by Labour, there was a massive reaction to back him as an independent. Margot, on the other hand, was not elected as a constituency MSP, but as a list MSP across Edinburgh. I was elected, and by the way, narrowly. We needed to get a minimum of 6% of the vote across Glasgow, and some people might think, oh, 6%, that's awful small. But when you're trying to get 6%, it's very, very difficult to reach that bar. We managed to get, I think, just under 7, so we did it. But we only got one person elected. And it's worth remembering that in 1999, the Greens never got anybody elected in Glasgow. They stood, but they never got anybody elected. So that shows you how difficult the bar was at the time. Now, as it happens, they managed to get somebody elected in Edinburgh, in the Lothians. So when we went into that parliament, the reason a lot of people call it the Rainbow Parliament was because you had me representing a socialist party, you had Robin Harper representing the Greens, you had Dennis representing independents, and you had Margot as an independent. So you had a situation there where there were voices in that parliament that were clearly about issues rather than party line. That those voices would be prepared to support things that were based on what they thought was right rather than what they were getting told by their parties. And that helped me as an MSP, because when I first introduced the abolition of warrant sales bill, in order to get a bill, a private member's bill, even discussed in Parliament, you needed a minimum at that time of 18 signatures. And you needed to show that you had broad party support. You needed at least three different parties prepared to support a bill. Now, in those days, because it was fresh, I was able to go to the likes of John McCallion for the Labour Party, Alec Neil for the SNP, Dennis Canavan, Margot MacDonald. And I was able to say to them, look, warrant sales, it's a curse, it's a disgrace, it's nothing to do with debt collection, it's nothing to do with humiliating the working class, it's not about genuine debt management, it's about frightening people. They were used during the poll tax campaign, but they were also used during the Highland clearances. So it was a piece of legislation that was a disgrace and it had to be removed from the statute book. I remember when I went to Dennis and said, Dennis, would you support my abolition of warrant sales bill? And he said, Tommy, not only will I support it, but I'll campaign for it, because I tried to do it in the British Parliament three times, and three times there wasn't time. They wouldn't make time for it. And it was quite ironic that they wouldn't make time in the British Parliament, but within 6 months of me raising that, it was tabled to be discussed. And it actually became the first private members bill that was passed in the Scottish Parliament, past 2000, with the support of John McCallion and Alec Neil, who were my co-sponsors, with the support of Dennis Canavan. And it's probably, to this day, Paul, it's the first and only time there's been a debate in the Scottish Parliament where nobody knew what the outcome was going to be. Because, believe it or not, the Labour Party had took a position on that bill, which was to vote it down. And Donald Dewar, shamefacedly, had come out of his sickbed to meet with the Labour MSPs to demand that they vote against it. Their argument was they couldn't give any kudos to me. They couldn't. The Law Society and the Society of Messengers at Arms, which represent the sheriff officers, they were all campaigning against it, saying that if this was introduced, they wouldn't be able to recover debts, that debt management would be a problem. And the likes of Donald Dewar, he was a former QC with a legal background, he was prepared to go with the Law Society rather than the people of Drumchapel, who he was supposed to be representing. And he argued at a eve of debate meeting. This meeting took place at lunchtime on a Thursday afternoon in the Friends Meeting House near to where the Scottish Parliament was meeting at that time. And the debate was to take place at 2 o'clock that day. So they were meeting at 12:30 in the Friends meeting house. And Donald Dewar, at the time, he was off work. He had a heart attack. He came out of his sick bed to attend that meeting because he'd heard that there was a rebellion, that the Labour ranks were saying, no, no, we can't vote against this. And the reason I know all this is because John McAlgan was at the meeting. So he's told us. And he argued vehemently that the Labour Party first manifesto that Keir Hardie introduced when they founded the Independent Labour Party had the abolition of warrant sales in it. How could you possibly now say that you were against the abolition of warrant sales? And a number of other Labour MSPs said, no, we can't do this. That meeting was very acrimonious and it went on a bit longer, so much so that when the debate started in the Scottish Parliament, the vote was clear. It was going to get voted down because Labour was going to vote against it and we didn't have the votes. The SNP were going to vote for it. The Independents were going to vote for it. But the Tories were against it. The Liberals were against it. And Labour were against it. So it was going to get voted down. Jim Wallace, at the time, he was a Deputy First Minister. He was a leader of the Liberals. He was speaking on behalf of the government. So I kick off, move the bill. He then comes in and moves the opposition. So that was clear. But then what happened, it was remarkable. There was all these wee notes getting passed on. No, it's buzz, 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 buzz. There was also some applauding from the chamber, which got condemned by the David Steele, who wasn't having any of this, you know. You weren't supposed to open your mouth and all that. But people were applauding when we were saying it was an attack on the working class, only ever got used against the poor and things like that. And what was happening was that Jim Wallace was just getting notice that the Labour ranks weren't on board. So when it came to the vote, what happened was most of them abstained. Some of them voted for it, and it tipped the balance, and that bill was actually passed against all the expectations.
Some of them voted for it, sorry, you mean the Labour MSPs rather than the Lib Dem
MSPs? Yes, some of the MSPs. Labour MSPs actually voted for it because they couldn't live with the idea that they would go back to Glasgow and say, I voted to keep Warren Sales, you know.
It would have been a disaster politically.
Most of them, unfortunately, abstained, which I think was cowardly. But the Lib Dems voted against it. The Tories voted against it. SNP voted for it. And it carried the day. It was a narrow vote, but it was a victory. And that bill was passed against the wishes of the Scottish government. That was a defeat for the Scottish government. In those days, the Scottish government was the Lib Dems and Labour. It was a coalition government. That's an example of the Parliament at its best, in my opinion, Paul, because the issue became about what was right and what was wrong, not about what the party of each of the MSPs had instructed them to do. And I think there should be a lot more votes in Parliament where MSPs are encouraged to deploy their beliefs and their integrity rather than their whips that were told today.
Aye, no, I would agree with that.
Whether we have the opportunity in 2025, I think it is, or maybe 25 or 26, is the next Scottish Parliament election, I'm not absolutely sure. I think it may be 26, actually. Those elections are going to be interesting because many people are disillusioned with the SNP on the question of independence. You're quite right to say the SNP have been good on the question of Gaza and the question of standing up for humanitarian law and condemning Israel for their absolutely disgusting, shameful attacks on the people of Gaza and Palestine. And for those who talk about October 7th somehow as a start of something, October 7th never started anything. 1948 started the occupation of Palestine. And for over 45 years, Israel has been condemned for illegally occupying Palestine. So don't give us any crap about anything that started on October 7th. The only thing that started on October 7th was Israel's full-fledged genocide against the people of Gaza and Palestine. You can't describe this as a war. This isn't a war, it's a slaughter. Wars are when two armies fight against each other. You know, what army is it that the people of Palestine have? They don't have a navy, they don't have an air force, they don't have an infantry. They don't have even the basics of an army. So there's no war going on. What there is a damn slaughter that's taken 32,000 lives so far, over 13,000 children. In fact, I read a report just the other day that since October the 7th, one child has been murdered every 10 minutes by Israel. Every 10 minutes, Paul. Every 10 minutes we've murdered a kid. It's a modern day genocide. And the fact that Labour and the Tories have backed Israel, have armed Israel, have enabled this genocide. America does not have the right to ever, ever raise the issue of human rights, of international law, ever again in its history. It has lost that right by being the enabler of Israel's criminal genocide in Gaza and Palestine. Whether we reach a situation in 2026 that there will be an ability for independents to stand and seek the second votes. I don't think independents are going to be big enough to win constituency votes the way Dennis Canavan did. Dennis was a particularly unique situation. Maybe, here I'm going to contradict myself, because we have Angus up in the...
Our Hebrides, is it?
Our Hebrides. And Angus McLe, he is somebody who, Angus Brendan, as he likes to always be reminded his name, he is someone who has represented that area for so long, and I know that he's declared he's going to stand as an independent. He may be somebody that could buck a trend. I'm trying to think of
Fergus
others.
Fergus Ewan's picture.
Perhaps another. Fergus may have enough constituency backing.
It's split the vote anyway, so it's
Angus great. Brendan McNeill is definitely on the, I would say, the more left side of the independence movement. Fergus probably isn't in the more left, but he's still a very, very solid independence campaigner. Fergus and I, we disagree in most other things, but we definitely agree on the fundamental nature of independence. And if he stood, who knows? Where I think there may be the ability for breakthroughs for other organisations, individuals, perhaps even parties, is in the second vote. Now, whether the ALBA party is going to be strong enough at that time, under the leadership of Alex Salmond, with Kenny McCaskill, Neil Hanvey, whether it'll be strong enough to secure enough second votes. It's an interesting question, because that bar's high, but see, once you reach that bar, there's then a bit of momentum behind you. So, you know, there is a chance that by 2026, ALBA could be the new kid on the block that manages to win enough votes from independentistas to give them the ability to have voices in that parliament, who are then going to argue that the Scottish Parliament has to be about independence, or else why is it there? Because at the end of the day, the unionists are using the Scottish Parliament now to tell us to pass on the cuts instead of opposing the cuts. And how long can that be sustained before people turn around and say, to hell with your Scottish Parliament, all your Danes cutting services?
Aye, no, I agree. There's obviously loads in there again, Tommy, great stuff. Have you heard, I don't want to say story, I don't know how to relay this. It's a heartbreaking one for Palestine. Hind Rajab, have you seen this one?
I'm not sure, Paul.
So it's a six-year-old lassie, same age as my son, so it's particularly heartbreaking for me when I seen this. I caught it through Al Jazeera, who've got kind of good coverage of the conflict, I would say, at the moment. It was a six-year-old lassie, and they've released the audio from her last telephone call, unfortunately, with emergency services. So she's in her car, surrounded by her dead family members, and she's telling them how frightened and how terrified she is, and if they can come and help her. I think the phone call lasts several hours, but they've not put sort of several hours of audio. And then there's like a tank approaching, and she's asking, you know, can you come and help me? There's a tank coming, I'm really scared, sort of thing. And the car's sort of riddled with bullet holes and all the rest of it. And then, you know, they're obviously trying to dispatch the ambulance there, because it's a war zone, right? You can't just be dispatching ambulances, because unfortunately they are and being targeted as well. So it took several hours for them to go, and then they lost contact with the paramedics who went on the scene as well. And it transpired they actually found the paramedics dead alongside this 6-year-old lassie. So that was a particularly really heartbreaking account, I suppose, is the word I was looking for there. I don't want to call it a story because it's for, if you're interested in your fellow human beings in any way, shape or form, I'd recommend people pause this and check that story out, because it's horrific. And to be fair, there's some journalists, you see these people at the White House stand in front of the plinth and they've got the banner behind them and they've asked them 4 or 5 times, what's the update on this? And they're just sort of saying, we don't have an update, we've asked them to investigate it. Well, it's been a fucking month or 2 months or 3 months. You have to put a timeline on that now, would be what I would say.
Paul, the problem is I go walking regularly with a couple of friends that I went to nursery school with, primary school, secondary school, pals all our lives. And Paul and John and I discuss these issues, and we've all agreed that you simply can't watch the accounts. You simply can't. You must watch some. I watch some because I'm on X and I'm on Facebook, and I'm desperate to share some of the horrors. I wouldn't normally share horrors, but you have to share horrors. I thought you were going to talk about the young girl account I seen, where she was carrying a cradle, and it was like a wee brother, it was a wee baby, and this young girl's carrying this cradle, running away, covered in dust and wounds in her face. And then there's another one of the wee child with the head is split open, bleeding, and the medics are pouring, I don't know whether it's water or antiseptic on the wounds, but the wee baby's screaming in pain because of the injuries they've sustained. And then there was the account I heard the other day, very similar to the account that you've gave, but this was a rescuer speaking to a child who'd been trapped in the rubble. The house had been blown apart. They had managed to secure contact with the voice, and the rescuer was asking the young child where her family was, and she tells him that her two sisters and her brother and their mother are under the rubble, and that she can see her brother's head, but it's been separated from his body. And hearing a child try and relay that to an adult, I just burst into tears. It's just as simple as that, mate. I defy anybody with a human fibre in their body to watch some of these accounts and not feel that they have to turn away, because the compulsion to want to cry, first of all in sympathy, but then in rage at what these bastards in the West are doing, Biden. I mean, the airdrop aid. Why? Because Israel will only allow lorries in. The most powerful nation on the planet decides to accept that a tiny wee nation called Israel can stop it from delivering necessary aid. This isn't a famine caused by natural disasters. This is a famine that's man-made, manufactured by Israel. Israel is now the single most rogue criminal state on our planet. When I hear the likes of Starmer, I know he's tried to backtrack, telling us that as part of their right to defend themselves, they can cut off water, food and energy supplies to millions of people and embark on collective punishment. Collective punishment is strictly, absolutely, specifically barred from the Geneva Convention of War. It's a war crime to collectively punish our people. They tell us that they're bombing hospitals. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the stories to begin with, Paul. They used to say, oh no, it wasn't us. It was Hamas. Hamas bombed the hospital. And then when that was proved to be a pile of shite, they then say, oh, what it is they're underground tunnels, they're underground tunnels. And then when that was shite, it was, oh, there are people hiding, there are people hiding. I couldn't care less if the whole of the fucking Hamas leadership were hiding in a hospital. It still doesn't give you justification to blow up a hospital. Surround the hospital. Wait for people to come out of the hospital. But to blow up a fucking hospital, it is utterly, utterly inhumane. It is barbarism. Barbarism. And yet, it's been enabled by America, by Britain, by France, the European Union. Listen, Paul, it is a black mark forever on the Western world now, and it's something that's changed the world, mate. You know, Israel, I was talked earlier about Pyrrhic victories. Israel might think it's winning. Israel has lost. It has lost everything. Israel is now standing exposed for the whole world as the bastard criminal that it is. It will never recover. So they might win battles, they might murder more and more children, but they'll never, ever again be seen as a reasonable nation in the world.
Aye, the only thing I would say, and I know it's obviously very emotive, this, but like, there's obviously Israeli citizens themselves that are out protesting this, so some the viewers might be younger, they might know the sort of backdrop there, so it's probably worth mentioning, you know, they were trying to get rid of Netanyahu for a while, and then obviously October 7th happened, and they're now, you know, saying they're a war cabinet, they're probably not going to have elections and the rest of it, so I agree that they're isolated, but I think as humanitarians, which we probably be for, you know, we need to think about how can we get the, you know, that message across about the Israeli citizens that are out protesting. And to be fair, I don't agree with the hostage taking. There's still 100 hostages, there's nothing being held at the moment. I would like to see them being released and obviously a truce being sort of sought there. Obviously the families of those hostages are putting serious political pressure on Netanyahu. So hopefully something's going to change soon, because this has went on for far too long now.
Even more than that, Paul, you're absolutely right, because when I'm condemning Israel, I'm condemning Netanyahu, I'm condemning the IDF, I'm condemning the most illegal, brutal criminal army in the whole planet, because that's what the IDF is. If you look at the videos that they're producing now, actually glorifying in murder, glorifying in the horrendous barbarism that's resulting in thousands of children and women and innocent men being murdered, referring to human beings as animals. So when I'm condemning Israel, that's what I'm condemning. But we've also got to remember, as you say, there are citizens within Israel who are opposed to this, and there are also Jews across the world who are not participating in protests. They're actually organising protests. You know, there are lots of cities in America where it's the Jewish population that are ashamed. Ashamed. I read one of the leading Jewish academics making the point that the Nazis, Hitler, made Jews frightened to be Jews. Netanyahu in Israel is making Jews ashamed to be Jews. That's what's happening. And the point I make about the world changing is, you and I, who are maybe interested in politics, you and I know that for over 70 years, you've had an illegal occupation, that you've had massacres. We know that this whole idea of right to self-defence, well, the right to self-defence is the country that's occupied. That's why Palestine has got the right to defend itself, because it's been occupied illegally by Israel. We know all of that. However, a lot of other people, they don't know that. They just read the garbage that they're getting from the mainstream media, and they think that it's Palestine and Palestinians that are the aggressors. You know, how dare they use catapults against tanks? It's a disgrace. They were throwing stones. The army had no choice but to shoot them. You know, it's the type of narrative that you get for the mainstream media. I don't think any sensible person on the planet now can see Israel as anything other than an illegal occupier now.
There was this concept of the silent majority during the Scottish referendum, and I think that's what's gone on in the new society. People may be scared to talk about it, you know. Anything you say, you're sort of, the word anti-Semitism is thrown about a lot, which is probably, I don't want to say too much about that, but
Paul, but you see, do you know what? We need to stop being frightened. We need to stop being self-censored. Because a lot of time what's happening is, you attack Israel, oh, you're an anti-Semite. No, no, no. Attacking Israel and attacking what they're doing to the people of Palestine makes you a human being, not an anti-Semite. It makes you a human being. And if you're not prepared to attack Israel, if you're not prepared to stand up and be counted and oppose and condemn this war and call for Israel to be isolated, to be boycotted, if you're not prepared to do that, then I question your humanity. I don't question whether you're anti-Semite or no. I question your humanity. And here's a wee thing, you know. We've got organisations like UEFA who were jumping through hoops to ban Russia from taking part in football tournaments because they invaded Ukraine. Where's the same actions in relation to Israel? You've got the Eurovision Song Contest coming up. We've got people saying, oh, we shouldn't have Russia involved in that. We're banning them, but we're allowing Israel to be involved. There's the hypocrisy, Paul, that we've got to stand up again and stop being self-censored. We're not prepared to accept that we're anti-Semite by attacking Israel and attacking Netanyahu. We need to stand up and do it.
So we've talked about it there briefly, right? So if Western democracy is sort of setting itself up, as it appears to be, as a sort of policeman of the world and the moral authority of the world, why do you think it is they spend, you know, invest so much time in sort of spying on, you know, social movements, environmental groups and trade unions and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I think people have to spend a bit of time thinking about the world and thinking about who runs the world and what their agenda is and what their narrative is. Read John Pilger, one of the, God rest his soul, but one of the best investigative journalists who ever lived. Read Oliver Stone, one book in particular, The Hidden History of America. There is no doubt in my mind that these people are promoting a very singular, biased, hypocritical view of the world. Controversially, Pope Francis, about a year ago, got condemned for daring, in my opinion, to speak the truth. Because against the grain, against the massive billionaire-owned media narrative, he asked people to consider that if the dog barks constantly at your door, does that constitute provocation? And he was talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Many people think that the invasion of Ukraine started 2 years ago, just over 2 years coming up, maybe even three. They're oblivious to the Mayadan massacre of 2014, they're oblivious to the bloody coup which took place that's overthrew the elected government of Ukraine, and a government that was friendly to Russia and had maintained the Cold War consensus that resulted in the destruction of the wall, that resulted in the reduction in the arms race. Russia said, look, we want guarantees for you. Ukraine borders us. We don't want missiles on our border. And the West said, no problem, that's fine. We've got no desire to include Ukraine within NATO. We've got no desire to have missiles sighted in Ukraine. And for many years, there was no conflict. By 2014, and funny enough, there was a lot of investment from Mr. Biden's son in Ukraine. It became clear that Ukraine wasn't doing what America wanted. The government wasn't malleable. They had to go. And the evidence for America's involvement is there in black and white, is there in the audios, is there in the emails. Go and look at it. Go and look at Oliver Stone's Ukraine on Fire documentary. Go and look at the absolute evidence that America engineered and supported the overthrow of the elected Ukraine government and the beginning of an 8-year assault on the Donbass, on the regions that bordered Russia. 14,000 killed over 8 years. 14,000 killed. But the narrative for the mainstream media is, oh, the war started 2 years ago. Never started 2 years ago. It started in 2014. And what happened was Russia felt that their security was so threatened that they had no alternative but to invade. I hate war. I think war is horrible. I think it's destructive. It loses the lives of working class kids on both sides. I hate it. But what Pope Francis was saying was, when that dog keeps barking at your door, do you need to answer? Do you need to do something? And what he was suggesting was that NATO provoked the war by suggesting that Ukraine was going to be joining NATO, that the missiles were going to be put into Ukraine. If I was Putin, therefore, because this is the question I put to people who say they're in Ukraine's side, I say to them, if you were Putin, what would you have done? What would you have done faced with the fact that NATO was about to put missiles on your border? I know what America did when Cuba in 1961 was going to accept missiles. America was prepared to start a nuclear war to stop it. What would happen if Mexico was to take nuclear weapons on behalf of Russia? You've got a response from Russia which was perfectly understandable and reasonable from their security point of view. It doesn't mean that you support what they did, but you understand why they did it. And it wasn't because they're looking to conquer the rest of the world. It's because they wanted their border to be secure. The world narrative is Russia's the aggressor. Everybody should hate Russia. I don't buy into that. I invite other people to say that they don't buy into that because they're sensible human beings. What did Russia ever do to us other than beat the Nazis? If it wasn't for Russia, we'd all be speaking fucking German. The truth is that they don't get the credit they deserve for what they sacrificed in the fight against fascism. And now we've got Bandera and the rest of the fascist hordes within the Ukrainian army getting funded by the West. It is the height of hypocrisy and irony, Paul, that we have got outwardly declared fascists within the Ukrainian army getting funded by countries like Germany that was supposed to be saying that it was never, ever going to go back to its past and it wasn't going to get involved in armaments trade. It's broken all that to support what's happening in Ukraine. So, controversial as it may be, I don't support Ukraine. I condemn Ukraine for what they've done up to the invasion and what they've done since. What they are doing is they're carrying out a proxy war on behalf of NATO. This isn't about Russia and Ukraine any longer. This is about NATO. This is about NATO saying, we're the top dog. Well, NATO was to blame for the invasion of Iraq, for the invasion of Iran, from what's happened in Syria and Libya. NATO, to me, is the biggest problem in our planet because they live off war. They rely on war for their very existence and they don't care at the level of destruction that they're responsible for. So I'm no NATO supporter. I condemn NATO. I would like to see NATO disbanded. NATO was set up at a time when there was a genuine Cold War between the Warsaw Pact and NATO. Well, the Warsaw Pact has declined and disintegrated. Why is NATO still there?
So this is probably a bit of a stupid question based on your sort of eloquent answer there. You went into a lot of detail, so I appreciate that. But why should the working class communities of Scotland and England, whatever else, whoever might be listening to this, care about regime change? You know, why is it important to them? If I'm a labourer for Les Mahago or a poet for Manchester or whatever, I'm not going to say one job is more important than the other, or just a fisherman for out of the Hebrides, why should you be interested in seek this stuff out, I suppose, is what I'm trying to ask.
I suppose I would go back to the 70s on this one, because in 1973, an elected government in Chile was overthrown. A guy called Salvador Allende, who was a lovely man, who was elected to be the president of Chile on the basis of attacking poverty and inequality, and he set about a programme which was about massive redistribution of wealth and power in favour of the working class of Chile, and tackling the crimes of hunger and illiteracy, and they did some fantastic things. But one of the things they did was they took over some of the American companies that were exploiting the people of Chile, and exploiting particularly the copper mines of Chile, because Chile had a rich vein of copper. And America organised, engineered, financed a coup to overthrow Salvador Allende and anyone who supported his socialist government. Well in excess of 50,000 were arrested, gathered into Santiago Stadium, 20,000 were murdered. Many of them were tortured first. And in a wee factory in East Kilbride, a group of workers were asked to repair a plane that had came in. And this plane was Chilean and was getting used to support Pinochet, the dictator of Chile, the army dictator who had overthrown illegally Salvador Allende. And those group of workers said, no, we're not doing it. We're in solidarity with the people of Chile. We're refusing to work on this plane. And they were disciplined and threatened with a sack. But the plane wasn't fixed. And that led to then shipyard workers and dockers across the world refusing to load ships that were destined for Chile to support that regime. That's what you call working class solidarity. That's solidarity between one group of working class people with another group of working class people. And that's why I think people should show an interest in what happens in other countries and be prepared to look beneath the surface. You know, if you think of a swan on a pond, you think, oh, that looks very, very calm. What you don't know is what's going underneath the water. And that's the way we have to look at society, because the media wants us to believe it's just the top of the surface and it's very, very smooth and it's an easy narrative. Underneath the surface, there's a lot going on, and a lot of that is about those in power, those with the wealth, those with the power, making sure the media sings their song, making sure the media promotes a message which is about that we should hate all the working class people, we should hate Russians. We should all be Russian phobia, because these bad Russians, they have invaded Ukraine. They're a disgrace. I listened to news bulletins on the way in from the BBC, which I despise as an institution because of its bias, despite trying to pretend that it's somehow or other independent. And on the way in, I listened to some arsehole from the Chatham House International Group of International Relations telling us that what happened in terms of the slaughter of 115 Russians in the stadium just the other night, it was actually Russia that organised it. This was the Russian state that did this. And they did this in order to get publicity and sympathy across the world. Now, when anyone suggested that the Israeli state should have known about what happened on October the 7th, and it was unrealistic to believe that they didn't know what was happening because of the amount of surveillance that they've got, and that when you see the footage that has been released from Al Jazeera to show that many of those killed on October 7th were killed by the Israeli army crossfire. When you say that, you're a disgrace, you're an anti-Semite, you're a Hamas sympathiser. How dare you say that? I've just listened to an asshole suggest on BBC that Russia organised for these four guys to go in with assault rifles and kill 115 people. Russia organised. But they get away with saying that. That's what I mean about the bias of the media. They're painting a narrative that they think we'll all buy and we'll all agree to, despite the fact that it's bullshit from start to finish. And that's why you have to ask people, Paul, to be prepared to independently read, independently analyse. Karl Marx had a wonderful expression. He used to say that his motto in life was to doubt all things. Doubt all things. In other words, ask questions. Investigate. Research. Don't just accept what somebody is telling you. Everything I've said here, I've mentioned Pilger, I've mentioned Oliver Stone. Go and read these people. Go and read the accounts that they've developed over years and years of meticulous research. They're not just sucking things out their thumb. They're actually providing evidence to back up their ideas. There's a guy called John Mearsheimer, Professor John Mearsheimer, who is an ex-American vet, fought in the Marines, got medals and all the rest.
So is Oliver Stone. He was in Vietnam, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And John Mearsheimer is the proponent of what they call the School of Realism, International School of Realism, International Relations. And he explains it black and white. Go and Google him, watch him on YouTube, subscribe to his channel. He's a very, very educated man, former diplomat, and he explains in no uncertain terms why things happen across the world and from the perspective of the various countries across the world. And he explains dot and comma how America organised, financed, engineered the coup in Ukraine and is responsible for the war in Ukraine. So if you really want to see the truth, go and Google Professor John Mearsheimer and watch what he's got to say.
I know if you're doing, Tommy, I know you've got somewhere to be and we're sort of pressed for time. There's loads of other things I wanted to talk to you and ask you about, but just conscious of the time. So working class, can we talk about class and why it's important in Scotland? Because I think me coming from a sort of working class background, I was sort of telling you earlier, I was always probably negatively judging people for other classes because I wrongly assumed, you know, they don't understand the struggle and, you know, they potentially couldn't be allies. But as I'm navigating my way through life, I'm sort of unpicking, you know, those biases that I had from my own sort of personal experiences. We talked about independence earlier, obviously. I think the working class and sort of middle class, as the academics would define them, need to be made aligned. There has to be less sort of suspicion between the two classes if we're going to get independence. So can you talk a wee bit about that and, you know, if you agree with that or you disagree with that, what's your thoughts?
Well, the Registrar General of Scotland would have you believe that people can be designated a class based on their employment. So anybody that is unskilled is automatically working class, but if you are semi-skilled or skilled, you're middle class. Other judgments will be based on levels of income. I have a much more simplistic view of society. I think there's workers and there's bosses. I think there's a ruling class and there's a working class, which means that I think the working class is a lot broader than what the social registrar would have you believe. I think being working class isn't just about your job. I don't think it's just about where you live. I don't think it's just about your income. I think it's about your attitudes. I think it's about your own personal history. I think it's about your outlook on life. I'm not prepared to accept that a guy who was raised in Pollock alongside me, who sticks in at school, gets a degree and becomes a teacher, has moved from being working class to middle class because he's now a teacher. He sells his labour. He has to get up and work for a living. That makes him working class. And it's from that point of view that I think my attitude to class, Paul, is much more about power. Who wields the power in society? No, the teachers, who are middle class, apparently. No, the engineers, who are middle class now because of their pay. Train drivers now. Well, most train drivers, because of the unions, have fought hard to get their wages. Most train drivers are on earnings of in excess of £40,000 a year. You look at the social registrar, they'll say, oh, that's in excess of an income, which means that you're now middle class because you're a train driver. Who's at a good wage? I think it's about attitudes, history, outlook. And from my point of view, class is important because you have to work out which side you're on. At the end of the day, I talked about train drivers there, or train workers in general. When the train workers go on strike, there's no room for you to sit on a fence. You'll just get a sore arse. You need to take a side. Are you on the side of the train workers, or are you on the side of the government? When the teachers were on strike recently, are you on the side of the teachers, or are you on the side of the employer? At the end of the day, being working class means you're prepared to stand with the working class. That means you stand with them during their struggles, during their fights, because at the end of the day, what they're fighting for is a broader, better share of the national wealth for the working class. And that's what we've got to stand for as socialists. End of the day, you know, Einstein, not a lot of people know this, but Einstein was a declared socialist. Einstein believed fundamentally that the best way to run society was when the wealth of society was socialised. The bosses don't want to socialise the wealth. What the bosses want to do is they socialise the losses. Whenever there's a problem in society, they want to socialise the losses. So when the banks go to the wall, who pays for that? Oh, well, we need to bail them out. We need to bail them out. But when the banks make billions in profit, oh, no, we need to be able to pay bonuses. We can't socialise that. So they're prepared to socialise losses but monopolise the gains. That's not for us. Our view of class has to be, where do you stand on the issues that matter between the powerful and the powerless? That's what makes you working class.
Aye, that was, I don't think we can end it any better than that, Tommy, so I think we'll call it there. I think that's episode 5 or episode 6. I'd appreciate, obviously, folk can sort of like and subscribe, and wish you all the best in the future, Tommy.
Thanks very much, it's been a pleasure, brother.
No worries, cheers, Tommy. Pleasure. Thanks, mate.